Connecticut Democrats, or Connecticrats, as they have never been called.
Welcome to the year-end edition of Connecticrats, the CT Dems podcast. I'm David Kostek.
And I'm Tara Kamen.
When we wrapped up our last podcast before the election, Tara and I were both feeling like the vibes were good. Some point during the night, on election night, the vibes started to feel bad. What was your election night like?
It was tough. My feminism class, actually, in college, decided to have a watch party together, which was honestly the best group of people to be with if we would have won. Also the best group of people to be with if, well, when we did lose. But it was tough. It was actually like very shocking for me as I was watching the numbers come in.
I was, you know, at the Connecticut Democratic Party headquarters, which was also Chris Murphy's headquarters and Victory Party in Hartford. And frankly, was so focused on Connecticut results. We had, you know, MSNBC on and it was in the background and the maps were up. And I'd occasionally look up and see, you know, this given county in Georgia or something with Steve Kornacki giving me some numbers. But I wasn't putting it together and I wasn't listening to the commentary from, you know, the anchors or talking heads there. So it didn't really hit me at all till probably a good couple hours later than everybody else. Only after the Connecticut stuff had wrapped, we'd done our reporting and, you know, from my point of view in Connecticut, we had a pretty good night, but nationally, totally different feeling, totally different vibe.
I mean, we were all just looking at the TV being like, red mirage, blue wave, red mirage, blue wave the entire time. And it was challenging to see it pan out the way that it did. But I think, I mean, we did an autopsy of this many times in a lot of my classes, and the result that we keep coming back to is just progress like cannot be linear, and that's just not the way progress really works. So I feel like there was great strides made in her campaign, and just she already broke so many boundaries and records in such a short period of time. I mean, she only really had 2 or 3 months, if that, to campaign. So I'm still proud of her, but it was definitely challenging.
We've had 3, you know, Trump elections in a row now. Right. Trump Clinton, Trump Biden and Trump Harris. And each of them, in a sense, is sort of a 49-48 election. Right. Like then I'm talking about the popular vote there where, you know, Clinton narrowly won and then Biden won by a little more in the popular vote and then Trump won by a little bit. So it's this image of 70 people in a room or so, 60 or 70 people in a room. One person switches sides. That's the difference between the Democratic administrations and all those judges and all of the administrative law that goes with it, along with, the economic gains and everything else that come with the Democratic administration. And now we have the Trump 2.0 administration coming in.
And it's astounding. In one of my classes, we were looking at the searches that were done after the election. And did you see how many searches there were for how do I change my vote?
Yeah, I know.
But, like, multiplied by a lot. And we were kind of talking about how people, you know, the entire election campaign, we were talking about like Project 2025 and all of these agendas that are in place. And over again, people would be like, well, not people. The Trump campaign would deny those claims and deny connection to any of those policy agendas. And we see as soon as he confirmed to kind of take that position to power, like he was immediately jumping to the bit to appoint people that have worked on Project 2025 or are active supporters of it into his cabinet. I mean, just his cabinet picks in general. And then also the stances he's been taking with like pardoning all of the January 6th rioters and all that kind of stuff has been a tough read for me, at least.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit more about that after the interview we've got upcoming. But, you know, again, here in Connecticut, it was sort of a different story. We picked up one seat in the Senate, so we already had a supermajority, and now we have the greatest number of senators we've had since 1986, and it stands at 25 Democratic senators to just 11 Republican senators. And then in the House, we broke 100 reps for the first time since 2008. So these are two of our largest majorities in a long time, And now the House of Representatives is also a supermajority in Connecticut, and we're at 102 of the 151 seats. So we did suffer a few tough losses in the House, two specifically, one in Torrington and one in Greenwich and Stamford. But we picked up six. So there were six new reps who picked up Republican seats in the House of Representatives in Connecticut. Kind of a good night across the board. Chris Murphy did well. Johanna Hayes won by a comfortable margin in her rematch with George Logan. You know, obviously Kamala Harris won the electoral votes of the state. And so it was an excellent night in Connecticut. It reminded me of 2010 when there was this Tea Party red wave across the country. But in Connecticut, we elected a Democratic governor for the first time in 20 years.
Yeah, I thought it was really awesome. And it was really gratifying to have, you know, door knocked and phone banked. I was phone banking 12 hours total the day before the election for Connecticut. And I, even when I was doing all those things, just like being surrounded by so many other people that were putting so much effort in, and I think it all really paid off very well in this state.
Yeah, we are in a pretty good shape. We'll talk a little bit about that as well after the break when we'll talk about the Connecticut legislature coming into session in January. But first, I sat down with Armin Thomas, who is a co-founder and partner at Split Ticket. You can find them at split-ticket.org. It's a website with a lot of sort of data-based analysis, and they do the predictive modeling like you might see from our past guests at Born to Run the Numbers or at you know, Nate Silver or 538 or any of those things. And he talks about their prediction and how close it was and how the polling played out, as well as trends that he's seeing both in the national scene and in Connecticut. This is Armin Thomas joining us on Connecticrats, the CT Dems podcast. So here we are feeling all down in the dumps because of the result at the presidential level. But one of my theories of the case is that Connecticut actually did pretty well in this election. So tell me what you see sort of nationally so far. And if you've looked at anything in Connecticut, and I think you have, what stands out for you in Connecticut's election results?
Yeah, so nationally, we as Split Ticket said Donald Trump had a 47% chance of winning the election, which, you know, many people would say to us, oh, you said that Harris had a 53% chance of winning. But, you know, 53% chance events do not happen, right? And that sure happens with, you know, large amounts of regularity, right? Things that have a 47% chance of happening oftentimes do happen, right? If you go and check the weather app and it says there's a 50% chance of rain, you're very good chance, you know, you're going to need an umbrella tomorrow. And that's essentially the situation that we saw, right? Donald Trump did better than his polls, and so the election did not apparently look to be very close. Statistically speaking, it could have gone the other way where Kamala Harris outperformed the polls, and she won in what would have been considered a blowout. It didn't turn out to be that way, but before the election, there was just as much evidence to say, oh yeah, you know, she could do a lot better in her polling. Now, in terms of what went into that, right, why was Donald Trump so competitive and why did he win the popular vote? Well, a lot of it has to do with the fact that he really improved on, you know, past Republican margins in really blue states, right? Like, you know, New York, California, you know, even Massachusetts as well. You know, Connecticut presidentially only people voted for Kamala Harris by 14 points, something like that, which, you know, is still blue, but, you know, with a very reduced margin. And that is in contrast to, you know, what you saw in some more of the whiter, you know, less diverse states, right? Which also coincidentally happened to be the states where Kamala Harris did the most campaign efforts, right? Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania. A lot of people blame the Kamala Harris campaign for what happens. And I think the truth of the matter is that if you actually look at the fact that those, you know, blue, you know, those blue wall swing states became the least Republican shifting parts of the country, I think that goes to show that whatever she was doing there was actually good, and that it was a matter of not being able to outswim something that I don't think any Democrat would have been able to.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, here in Connecticut, Trump, look, Trump's been on the president's ticket three times, right? So we've got three results that we can compare, 16, 20, and 24. And yeah, this was his high watermark at 41.9% of the vote, right? So that's the highest Trump got in Connecticut. But that only compares to 40.9 I've got down here for the Clinton race in 2016. You know, so it's not a huge swing, but you're right. When it's a 50-50 toss-up margin thing, a 1% shift nationally would have been it, right?
And the key thing is, right, everybody knew to some degree that he was going to do better with the, you know, working class minority people who had been voting Democrats forever, right? The polls might have, you know, at the time I thought, okay, they're mostly right, and they might be overstating the degree to which this happened. They were not, right? But it was also very much a, I'll believe it when I see it type of thing, because there's really not a lot of evidence to suggest it. The corollary to that is that we all thought, okay, even if this does happen, Kamala Harris should improve in educated, white, you know, suburban areas that have been trending more Democratic for the past three, four election cycles. And the fact that that did not really happen is ultimately what doomed it, right? Like, just looking here at what the New York Times has. Donald Trump got 40% of the vote in Darien, got 42 in New Canaan, right? He's knocking on 39 in West Haven, right? He's winning East Haven by double digits, right? These are all fairly college educated areas. And, you know, East Haven has the Italian exception, which I can go into later. But for all of those are areas that if they're not shifting left, the theory of the case is just gone, right? For the past 20 years, since Al Gore made the decision to campaign on a set of issues that permanently made the Democrats a party for liberals, right? The entire thesis of how Democrats win has been, okay, we're going to be liberals. We're going to lose some more of our old working class conservative bona fides that we used to have because we're liberals now. But that's okay because we're going to make it up with educated people who used to be Republican and they're going to come over to our side, right? And for the past two decades, that theory has more or less withstood what you would, you know, see in variations in the national environment. And in 2024, that, you know, now, you know, the Democrats' luck kind of ran out on that. And there are many theories as to why this possibly could happen, right? Inflation is obviously one of them, right? But also seeing that these are, you know, wealthier areas, which should not, you know, feel the pinch of inflation as much, there's got to be some other stuff as well. Now, I'm not a pundit. I'm not, you know, Matt Iglesias or David Shore or any of those people. So I won't pretend to, you know, do what they do, you know, outside of, you know, my own rantings in my Twitter group chats. But clearly there's something there, right? Because there's a theory of how you're supposed to win. That theory was not there, right? Now, when you look at the down ballot stuff, right? Most down ballot Democrats, they did, to some extent, feel the blunted, like, they got blunted by the top of the ticket cratering, but they still did not really get destroyed, right? Trump did not really have a ton of coattails in most of the country, right? Except in, you know, maybe Pennsylvania and, you know, Florida, perhaps, right? But especially in Connecticut, right? You know, the Republicans, they've been trying to gun for Johanna Hayes for years now. Right. They've been trying to win back that fifth district since 2006, I think. And it is on paper the kind of district that you would expect the Republicans to win. Right. It's got a lot of these, you know, blue collar working class minority towns. It's got a bunch of angry Italians. Right. Right. You know, like the towns around Waterbury, they're some of the reddest in the state, and they all have very, very high concentrations of Italian ancestry, which is correlated with very large, you know, swings towards and very large vote margins netting out of, you know, for Donald Trump. And then, you know, the liberal base, right, in this district, is some amount of, you know, the Hartford, you know, western suburbs and also the Northwest Hills, right? And the Northwest Hills is filled with the types of people from the New York media market who have been, you know, huffing all of this, I don't like the Democratic Party energy that's been coming out of the tri-state area. So on paper, it is absolutely the kind of district that the Republicans would be able to win. You know, it voted you know, very comfortably for Biden last time, but Hillary barely won it. Kamala Harris, I think, is probably going to barely win it as well, too. However, you know, Jahana Hayes, you know, evidently, you know, was not hit to the same extent as Kamala Harris was in the district. She won. She beat George Logan by 7, right? Let's at least compare the margins right here. So Waterbury is split, which is going to make the comparison a little bit
it's a little tricky. Here.
But if we look at New Britain, right? So Harris has won New Britain by about 5,000 votes, right? 61 to 37. Hayes is winning it by about 6,000 votes, you know, 65 to 35, right? And so it's, you know, those are the key Democratic bases in the seat, right? It's very different, you know, from most of the other districts in Connecticut, in that it's the only real one in the state where the base is very concentrated in minority areas, right? In the fourth, now you have, you know, the Gold Coast. You know, 20 years ago, it was all Bridgeport and Stamford versus the rest of the seat. But now the Gold Coast is really, you know, punching above its weight. And then in the third, you have New Haven, but you have Camden, you have Brantford. You know, you have all those other very well-to-do white towns around there. The first is, you know, again, got a lot of, you know, liberal white areas. And then the second, you know, I love Eastern Connecticut. I don't think it gets enough love on Twitter. But, you know, that is, you know, the most New England-y part of the state, right? It's the most white. It's the most traditionally, you know, secular, you know, working class Democratic. And Joe Courtney will, you know, probably have that seat for as long as he wants.
Sure.
But with the fifth, you know, the Republicans keep sinking that seat into it. But I have to think that, you know, Hayes is just a good campaigner. And especially in order to win that seat, either Trump would have had to win it outright by a couple points, or, you know, you would have had to avoid those down ballot lag problems in those working class minority areas, right? In New Britain and in Waterbury and Danbury. And Logan did not really seem like the type of person who was able to put that type of candidate, you know, that type of campaign together for the fifth.
Well, in 22, he pretty much...
In 22, he
now
did.
It's very different when there's not a presidential ticket and the turnout, you know, profile and all that.
He almost
but
won,
man,
because of most of the minority vote in those, you know, blue-collar post-industrial cities. Right. And, you know, in Massachusetts, they're kind of the southern extension of the Springfields and the Holyokes and the Worcesters as well. Right. It's that same type of vibe. Those areas just simply did not show up to vote in 2022. And in 2024, they did. And the marginal voter there, while they probably were more Trump curious than you would have expected, that did not translate yet down ballot to the GOP. Now, in terms of what this shift Trump is among minorities, many people are divided, right? Some people are saying, oh, it's just a Trump thing because of the checks and the inflation and some machismo stuff that they say, right? Some other people think that it could be, you know, ideological realignment, the same way that you saw, you know, Southern whites, you know, Northern ethnic whites like the Italians and the Polish and the Czechs and, you know, all of those, you know, go from being Democratic and swingy constituencies to becoming more of a hard right GOP leaning thing, right? If you're a Democrat, you really gotta hope that's not true. But, you know, it possibly could be that.
Isn't the core of that question though? Would it apply to a presidential candidate who's not Trump? Right? Like,
well,
would this
that's
same
what we're
trend,
need to
and that's
see.
What, we don't know because he's had this grip on the party now for over 10 years. So we don't know, but that's the question, right? These trends may just be unique to this one you know, megalomania.
Well, that's going to be what the Republicans, you know, have to figure out, right? I mean, it's the same question that Democrats probably asked themselves after 1964, right? The South had been voting Democratic for a century, and then they voted Republican for obvious reasons. And then, you
but
know,
not immediately.
For president, they did, right? And then after right? Well, exactly, right? It took a little bit of time to filter down ballot. But again, the internet didn't exist back then. Social media didn't exist back then. All of that does now, right? The way that political relationships have changed, you know, the way that those relationships are made has changed so much from 50 years ago, right? But it's the same type of thing where in 2008 and 2012, people said, oh, Obama did really badly in Kentucky and in West Virginia and in Tennessee and in those types of places, you know, because he's liberal and, you know, because he's a black man, right?
And he wasn't Bill Clinton, right?
Yeah. And so the theory is, oh, if we just, you know, run, you know, it's just like a they hate Obama thing. You know, when we run someone who isn't Obama, these people will come back to us. And then we run Hillary Clinton and, you know, we see what happens after that, right? So if this sort of thing happened in the past to demographics that once reliably voted for Democrats, the theory is, what's to say that it could or couldn't happen again, right? And we won't know until it actually happens, right? But it's just, you know, it's just something to think about. But in terms of Connecticut, right, I don't think the state in general is in any danger of, you know, flipping red anytime soon. Unless, you know, Nikki Haley ran against Joe Biden. That would be the only scenario in which I think, you know, the state might have actually flipped. And even then...
Really? At the presidential level, you think that would have been a possibility? Because the former Republicans, now reliable Democrats at that level, would migrate back?
So I think the theory of the case there rests on the fact that whatever Kamala Harris's approvals were and the reason she lost, it's not because they are mad at her specifically, right? They were mad at her because she was, you know, the face of the Joe Biden administration that was on the ballot they wanted to punish, right? It is very difficult for me to see how the face of Joe Biden, that's Kamala Harris, would do any worse than actual Joe Biden being on the ballot. And if Kamala Harris only lost the state or won the state by 14, right, there are plenty of educated, liberal, white people who are Democrats and all that who, you know, really did not love the idea of voting for, you know, Joe Biden, right? We saw this in polling as well, right? Initially, right, it was up until that debate in June or July, whenever it was.
Same.
And then it was there the couple of weeks, right? If Biden had stayed in, you know, everybody looks at Biden when he dropped out. But imagine 3 to 4 more months of negative press and the headlines continuing to pile and pile and pile. The campaign morale would have completely collapsed, right? Plus, if you had, you know, Haley or, you know, a more competent Republican candidate, you know, at the helm there, she would be the type of person to actually try and bring some of those people back, right? Maybe not necessarily to Romney margins, because that's not the way realignment works, but, you know, she possibly could have flipped Darian and Buchanan back outright, right? If you look at the Senate race, and this was a very interesting result, Chris Murphy only got 52% of the vote in Buchanan, and he only got 52% of the vote in Darian against Matthew Corey, who's, you know, rando Republican, right? Like, and Chris Murphy's a pretty solidly strong and Democratic incumbent in the state. Could you imagine what Joe Biden, who is, you know, less popular than the Yankees are in Fenway Park, right? Could you imagine how he would have done in Connecticut, right? Especially when the people who already were showering on him the most were younger and minority voters, right?
I'll back a little and say, look, if you look back, you know, I used to live in New Canaan, and that's where I first got active in Democratic politics. And we were a 35% party across the board in New Canaan. Like, we never, like, Jim Himes would get, like, you know, 38% or something, maybe 40.
Oh, yeah. I think he won it for the first time.
Yeah, this is back, like, 2008, 2010, 2012. The notion that any Democrat would win New Canaan by any margin was rather insane in 2012, right? So it was just a question of holding down the margins there while running them up elsewhere for someone like Congress or Senate to win. Okay, so Murphy's 52 there is actually, like, stunning. It's actually kind of really stunning. And that's in now when you switch to presidential at that time, you know, Obama is carrying Connecticut easily in 2012 and 2008. You have to go back to 1988 to get a Republican winning. I don't think Haley would have won. I don't think anybody, any Republican would have won Connecticut, even against Joe Biden.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think reasonable people can disagree. I mean, I think that pre-2024, everybody had these, you know, more rigid frameworks of, I think, the error bands of where everything is, you know, put. But if you start, you know, Trump only lost New Jersey by 6.
New Jersey was weird.
Doing a single dollar of campaigning there, right? And New Jersey's a little bit different, but it is similar to Connecticut in many ways, right?
It is.
Like, it's got a big urban corridor. It's got a, it's very diverse, you know, population. Mm-hmm. One of them on the headcanons is that I think Connecticut should replace New Hampshire as a first in the nation primary state.
Where were you a year and a half ago? We need you lobbying at the DNC for us. We pitched. We had a good pitch. I'm not going to say it was rigged, but we had a good pitch.
If only to see Pete Buttigieg and Dean Phillips eat at Sally's and Modern and all of those other, you know, pizza places in New Haven.
I could raffle off a dozen reasons why Connecticut should be the first in the nation primary.
It makes so much sense, right? It has every possible demographic you could want to test people out in.
And it has two media markets. One is very expensive. One is not. The Hartford-New Haven market is not that expensive. So an upstart candidate who doesn't have a ton of money coming into the early primaries could still do well. You know what I mean? Like, it's not with enough retail campaigning in the state, and it's an easy state to retail campaign in.
Yeah, yeah. There's 159 DTCs that you have to go hit up. It's not especially, yeah, it's not the toughest nut in the world to crack. But right, if Trump could lose New Jersey by 6 by doing nothing, right? You know, New Jersey and Connecticut in 2020 were not that far off from each other in terms of partisanship, I don't think, right? So there's a lot of random chaos there. And it might not have happened, but I think the chance of a competitive presidential race in Connecticut in a bad enough year for Democrats is a lot higher than people would think. In terms of the governor's race, right, down ballot, I think Democrats probably are fine. I mean, Ned Lamont seems to be doing the impossible of being a governor who isn't completely hated in the state, you know? So, I mean, he won very convincingly last time. He carried Darien and New Canaan in 2022.
Again, right? I mean, unthinkable 10 years earlier. Absolutely unthinkable 10 years earlier.
Oh, I mean, that those two towns almost got Stepanowski the race in 2018. I remember that year. So many of my friends were out in the New Haven polling lines for hours, and you know, the ballot counting was there. It still does not compute to me how many, you know, seats there would have been in the legislature which would have voted for Hillary but elected Republican representatives. Because the legislature was tied in the House, if memory serves me
very
correctly.
Close. I think we had like a 4-seat majority, yeah.
And Hillary did terribly in the state by historical standards, but she still did win comfortably. When you mentioned 1988, George H.W. Bush won Connecticut. He did. I mean, I made a map of it. It's actually a very interesting look at what the old, you know, partisan coalitions used to be in the state, right? The entire Naugatuck Valley used to be blue, right?
Very.
Even Walkett and Prospect, right? Which is unthinkable today, right? How much would a Democrat have to win the state by for those towns to be blue today?
I think Walkett is the most Republican voting town.
Either Walkett or Voluntown. One of those two.
I think it might be Walkett. Yeah.
Right. So those things change. And, you know, that is the real story of the 2024 election as analysts look at it is that people are not demographic variables that are just manipulatable into models all the time that, you know, are rigid. Right. Your models should always be changing. Right. Your models should always have the idea that there's more uncertainty. Right. Yeah. We gave Donald Trump a 47% chance of winning because, you know, the polls objectively showed Kamala Harris ahead. Right. There was not a database case for Donald Trump to win. There just wasn't. Right. Or at least if you went by the way the polls were looking, Kamala Harris was ahead unless you were doing some of this unskewing polls nonsense that some of these people, you know, do. The thing is that people said the same thing about Hillary in 2016, except if you really go back and look at it, Hillary's lead in a lot of states was never really that strong, right? It was never that strong in a lot of, you know, in a lot of states. And at the time, the statistical literacy was not as high as it is today. And so people didn't understand what correlated error was as widely as they do now, right? If you are underperforming your polls by a couple points in one state with a lot of working class white people, you're probably underperforming it across the board in places with demographics like that.
Right. Places aren't really special. Right. Places aren't really special. Right. There's a shift that happens. It's a shift. You should experience it almost everywhere.
Right. Because this is not, you know, 1940, right? Like where there's 50 separate elections with their own isolated political machines that are going on. Right?
And media universes.
Yeah.
Right.
Social media, the internet's kind of leveling all of that around. Okay. Right. That's the big story of the past couple of decades. And so, you know, when you look at all that, you know, Harris is up by 1 point in the poll or whatever. Polls are routinely off by a couple of points, right? This happens. Polling has never been meant to be an exact science, unless you can get ridiculously large sample sizes like you do in India, right? In India, the polling sample, they're like 30,000 people and all that. But you could never do that here because that would cost more money than most campaign, you know, committees have. And so you do what's best, right? And you just have to widen the error band. So that 47% of uncertainty had a lot of room for a lot of things. I think that in terms of what didn't go well for Democrats in Connecticut, I mean, just looking at the, I mean, Ryan Fazio won, which I know Democrats would have hoped to not lose that seat. Right. And that's the thing about those types of seats. And as someone from Massachusetts, I can very, you know, proudly speak from experience, is that if you are a Republican who is in a highly educated seat like that with a history of, you know, down ballot Republican lag, like much of, you know, the Gold Coast is, if they try to come at you a couple of times and they fail, right, eventually they're going to give up. So I think in terms of 26 for the Fazio race, I mean, I'm not an expert in Gold Coast candidate recruitment, but it definitely is absolutely a race. You know, Trump midterm, you know, strong Democratic ticket on the ballot. However, I don't think, you know, a lot of election Twitter legislative forecaster people would probably say, oh, it's, you know, he's going to start out as an underdog, you know, just because of the nature of the district and the nature of the national environment. But I don't believe that for a second. If you're using the
Sabato crystal ball method, it's toss up. It would be toss up the whole time. Like it would stay gray and be toss up the whole time. Yeah.
It would be a toss up unless, you know, the Connecticut Republicans nominated somebody like Mark Robinson for governor and, you know, they dragged everybody down on the ticket.
I always give them more credit than they end up earning in their primaries. Who knows? I've given up on guessing at what Connecticut Republicans are going to do. I thought I knew in 2018 who they were going to nominate for governor. They didn't. I thought I knew who they were going to send up against Lamont last time. I was wrong. And I thought I knew who was going to run against Dick Blumenthal, and I was wrong there. And I thought I knew who was going to run against Chris Murphy, and I was wrong there. So there's something in me that cannot think like a Connecticut Republican, and that's probably why I have the job I do. Aaron, thank you for joining us here today. This was great. Splitticket.org is the website.
Split-ticket.org.
Oh, yeah, there's a hyphen in there. Split-ticket.org. And you're on all sorts of social media, sometimes under an avatar.
Oh, yeah. Well, no longer. No longer anymore.
I know. I saw on Blue Sky you're using your real name.
But yes, thank you. Happy to be here.
So there has been a great deal of thinking and analysis around this election. You know, we heard Armin talking about that in our interview. We were chatting with it a little bit before. But ultimately, we now have a new normal to adjust to, don't we? Is it a new normal or is it simply not normal?
I mean, it's never going to be normal. And I don't think... Well, I think the most important thing that we should be doing is making sure that it never gets normal and that we're constantly making sure to remind ourselves and others that this is not the way that our government typically functions. And it should not be the way that our government functions.
It hasn't been the way our government functions until 2017. And there were, you know, some people around the guy who reined him in, right? Many of his worst ideas and worst impulses were controlled. And you could see with the initial cabinet picks that that is not going to be the case this time. The Matt Gaetz pick, which went down in flames pretty quickly, was one indication of that. But, you know, the guy at FBI, and I got to tell you, the new attorney general pick ain't great either. Her name was Pam Bondi. She was AG of Florida for a period of time and, you know, accepted a $25,000 campaign donation from Mr. Trump. And magically, some civil lawsuits and pending litigation against him went away. So anyway, what are you seeing in the cabinet picks? Which one's particularly alarming, or are there any that are in any way reassuring?
I'm looking at Pete Hegseth, which is incredibly scary for me, because not only is he a TV presenter who has little to no qualifications for what he is going to need to be doing, he also has an alleged drinking problem. And I just feel like that is incredibly challenging to perform a role at that level and then also be an alcoholic. So I'm definitely very concerned about that. Very concerned about RFK's position. I don't think he should be anywhere near health, given how anti-healthcare general opinions he has been. I mean, from anti-vax to some of his stances on fluoride and water, he scares me. One that I maybe controversially... Okay, I wouldn't say that I'm excited for this or hopeful for this. I just want to see how this plays out, just because no one has ever done it before. I want to really take a look at this new department, DOGE, for general efficiency. I don't know what Elon Musk's qualifications are to clean up a bureaucratic function and make it more efficient, but I do think it would be interesting to see him try to take a stab at it.
It did sort of happen once before. Al Gore ran an initiative during the Clinton campaign to seek out, you know, sort of waste, fraud, and abuse and streamline government as well. You know, it is something that you know, the administration, the Clinton administration paid some attention to in what I'm going to assume is a more legitimate way back in the 90s. You know, could government be more effective and efficient? Yes. But what is the U.S. government, right? U.S. government is essentially a, you know, health insurance and retirement security system for elderly people and a massive standing military. That right there is something like 70-80% of the spending that goes on in government between defense and Medicare and Medicaid. You start looking at veterans health care as well. That's another significant chunk. Everything else after that, you look at the Department of Education and what people may consider, you know, wasteful spending on X, Y, or Z, or foreign aid, or administration of the federal courts. Like, literally everything else the federal government does is a very tiny sliver of the spending that's done. So if they're going to, you know, cut $1 trillion or something, as they set as a benchmark, you're talking about Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and the Department of Defense.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly interesting to me that, especially given what's going on in foreign affairs and whatever, one of my big concerns heading into these next couple months in the Trump administration is I don't want those headlines to take people's attention away from the very real changes that are happening in this country. And I think it's important that we, you know, I mean, as citizens of this country, like, do our best to make sure that our needs are being met as much as possible. And protest and organize and all those kinds of things when we see it not happening. Because one thing that I'm very concerned about in this next administration really is honestly the Supreme Court. I mean, I can't even fathom like another Supreme Court justice being put into place and swaying the courts even more and going back on God knows how many decisions.
Yeah. If the three liberal justices, are still with us at the end of Trump's term, you could even get the case where Thomas or even Alito step down on purpose and lock in another, 30 or 40 years of conservative justices in those seats. And if the cabinet picks are any indication of the difference between a Trump term one and a Trump term two, one could only imagine what court picks are going to be like. You know, Trump in the first term did nominate and get confirmed through the Republican Senate a number of court picks who were judged unqualified by the American Bar Association, something that was unheard of previously. I suspect we're going to see that more and more and more as being an ideologue is more important than being a jurist.
Yes, 100%. And something that I want to continue seeing this Trump administration is conservatives that are in the House and the Senate right now that aren't maybe Trump conservatives or Trump Republicans sort of standing up to him and hopefully maybe safeguarding us from some of the more extreme kind of proposals put forward, because I do think that there is some concerns with his cabinet picks among Republicans themselves as well. So I'm hopeful that some of these cabinet picks and other decisions will be rejected.
I have learned to not hold my breath waiting for Susan Collins to do the right thing. It's just not going to happen, in my opinion. I share your hope that that happens, but I have zero optimism about it. In the end, if you need 50 votes plus, the vice president, they'll get 50 votes plus the vice president, especially now that they have a few to give. Alisa Murkowski or Susan Collins can vote no and still pass through these justices or confirm these picks. And as far as like true conservatives, I want to push back on this idea of what is a conservative now, because so little of Trump's agenda is conservative. The notion of tariffs is anathema to conservatives. That is an enormous deviation. That's 180 degrees away from conservative sort of economic ideas. And that is a centerpiece of what he wants to do. And the idea of this sort of centralization of power in the presidency is not something that conservatives typically used to believe in, but now that they've got their guy, they believe in it for their guy.
Yeah, it's very interesting how republicanism is changing this country and how distant it's gotten from conservatism. And there was a time when people would be like, oh, I'm fiscally conservative and socially liberal, but now it almost seems like with the new Republican Party, people are socially conservative, and I wouldn't say fiscally liberal, but definitely fiscally populist. So seeing the way that the party is kind of changing and realigning is interesting. And I think really taking a look at those dynamics and thinking about them is going to be important for Democrats moving forward to strategize in future elections.
There may be something in that about that shed some light on the Connecticut results, right? The notion that the true conservatives and Trump conservatives are different things. And the whole notion of being a Trump Republican does not play in this state. And so we're seeing them sort of lose elections and lose elections and lose elections, and we're chipping away. I saw someone pointed out in the Connecticut Mirror that we picked up 24 seats since 2018. So that is, just an indicator that Connecticut is sort of different than the rest of the country.
Yes, I 100% agree. And I think that's probably because people in Connecticut have really seen Democratic policies work for them. And it's been enough time that they have been able to really see them in action and how they've impacted their lives. And we're getting positive feedback. So that's always a great thing.
The next legislature is seated January 8th. So all the folks that won their elections back in November start work on January 8th. The House caucuses have announced the chairs of various committees and all that stuff. So the sort of nuts and bolts work has already begun. But we'll start seeing legislators legislating on the 8th. I think attacking the energy question in Connecticut, especially the high cost of electricity, is going to be a paramount one. And moving on some climate bills and environmental bills generally is going to be a big priority, because in the last few sessions, it feels like those fell by the wayside.
I'm really looking forward to hopefully some bills and policies on housing affordability in Connecticut, because I know housing costs are going up. And also maybe something that brings jobs into the state as well. I know Connecticut's been having a little bit of a tough time keeping young people in the state after they graduate college. So I would love to see some programs about that.
We'll see what they come up with, and we'll be talking to the legislators who make it happen in the coming editions of Connecticut's the CT Dems podcast. And we have a little bit of news about the podcast. Do you want to share?
No, you go ahead.
All right. We have been an audio-only medium for the run of this show, which has been about 4 years. We're going to make that legendary pivot to video. So yes, if you've been listening through you know, your Apple Podcasts or on Spotify, please continue to do so. We'll still be here. But we're additionally going to add a video version of the podcast as well, and we'll see how that goes. So I've got to come out from behind, like the wizard. I've got to come out from behind the curtain, and people can really see that it's all just smoke and mirror. Wait, no, I've blown the analogy.
Face reveal coming soon. I know you guys have been really wondering what we look like, so make sure to watch our YouTube videos.
We won't be back for a little while, probably in February, as we get into the municipal season coming up ahead of us, right? Next elections, next November, are all about the towns, your mayors and first selectmen, boards of finance, and the ever-important boards of education will all be on your ballot. We'll talk all about that stuff and about the legislative session once it's underway here on Connecticut's CTM's podcast. We'll see you next time.
Stay tuned. Happy holidays.